You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day.
And hot. We can go ahead and say hot. The National Weather Service has blessed us with their bright yellow icon on the weather forecast for today and tomorrow, because it's going to be in the upper 90s to low hundreds. We are recording this show on June 5th, 2024, for broadcast on June 6th, 2024. By the time it broadcasts, we will have passed the peak of the current heat wave that we're experiencing.
Just 104.
102, 104, depending on which station you're looking at. That doesn't make that much difference, I think, between the 2 degrees. They are saying that today, Wednesday, will be 102 in West Sacramento, 104 in Davis, somewhere in that range in the Vacaville area. So you get the idea. As you get further into the valley and further up the valley, it's hot. There's a great big dome of high pressure sitting over, I think it's Montana. And we're on the edge of it. So this is one of those times when you can go to sites, fun ones like Ventusky, did I get that name right? .com. And you can take your little cursor and you can go from Sacramento and drag it down Interstate 80 towards Fairfield and watch the temperature drop as you get closer to the coast, which is one of the pleasant aspects of living where we do, is that the closer to the coast you are, the earlier we cool off in the evening, and the less extreme our high temperatures are, typically depending on the magnitude of that high pressure dome. 102 degrees today, Wednesday, Thursday, the day of the broadcast, will be 96. We might have noticed last night it only got down to about 67 degrees, which is about 10 degrees above our typical night temperatures here. We aren't accustomed to that kind of thing here in the Sacramento Valley, but it happens every summer at some point. Thursday night will be clear, 58 degrees, should cool off fairly nicely as we get into the early evening. Friday, temperatures are going to drop down to about 90. Friday night, 55 and clear throughout. There's no clouds really anywhere at the moment. Saturday, 90 degrees and sunny. Saturday night, partly cloudy, 59 degrees. Sunday is also going to be in the 90, 91 degree range. Sunday night, 58. Then after that brief period where a trough moves through, another ridge is going to build and will be warm. Some people might say hot, but Monday and Tuesday high temperatures are going to be 96 degrees, and Monday night, Tuesday night, about 59 to 60 degrees. So more in the typical range for this area. So this is a little bit of a short duration heat wave. It's the first one of the season. It's funny how people have been reacting to it like this is some epic event. Oh my God, it's going to be 100 degrees. So I went back. My industry, my business is affected by temperatures and rain and things like that. So I just, as I track revenues, I also just make notes on a week-to-week basis about the weather and what the weather has been like. In June, we always have heat waves at some point. Every June for the last 4 years, we've had a heat wave at least 1 week of the month of June. And some years, like 2022, we had 2 heat waves in the month of June. So I just note this down. It's not uncommon, of course, in the month of June with the days as long as they are and the part of the season where we are, for us to have a 2 or 3 day 100 degree plus event. Nothing is breaking records. Nothing is going to be that harmful to your garden. Just briefly on that, a question came up on Facebook group. What do you do when you have little plants? They're talking about little vegetable starts, and whether should you go out and plant them before the heat or hold them until after the heat? And there's a pretty vigorous back and forth, but most people came down on the, oh, I don't plant when it's about to get hot. I wait until after it's hot. All right, this is fine. I mean, either answer is correct. It's one of those cases. There's no right answer here.
It depends on how good you are at watering.
Well, in both cases, it does, because yeah, I can tell you something. Exactly. I have spent many years managing plants in pots, okay, including many, many, many plants in small pots, including 6-packs, cell packs, 4-inch pots, quart pots, 1-gallon containers. When it's hot, and particularly when it's windy, as it was yesterday and the day before, the north wind, very, very low humidity, we water everything in our garden center when we come in, and we are sure to water almost everything in smaller containers, 1 gallon and smaller, before we leave. It's not uncommon for us to also water them in the mid part of the day. So this is my guiding principle. It's way easier, in my opinion, my experience, to manage a plant's moisture needs in the ground than in a pot. If you, now, you should not go out there personally. Why? You yourself, when it's 104 degrees, you should not be out there planting. It's not good for you. But the plant in the ground has all that extra moisture around it if you've watered it thoroughly when you plant it. So I, on Monday night, without planting a lot of vegetables that I have to get them in the ground, give each one a 0.5 gallon to 1 gallon of water, which is way more than the pot needs. So I'm watering the soil all around it. Those plants, I checked them again this morning. Remember our motto, check daily, water as needed. I checked them again this morning. One of them needed water. All the others had been planted Monday night, really didn't need water this morning. That, why? Because there's all that moisture around. Also, the last step in planting, in my case, and I would suggest this in yours, is I mulch them lightly with something. I happen to have a bag of our product that we sell at our garden center called Fir Mulch, which is a compost product. So I use that. Each one got a little ring of that around it right after planting, water, mulch, water once more to kind of settle the mulch in. Those plants, you know, 2 days in now have not actually needed water. I'll check them again this evening, obviously, when it's 100 and something degrees. I will go out there and check them. But I find it much easier to manage them in the ground than in containers. If you forget to water a plant in the morning before you go to work, and it's in a 4-inch pot, when you get home, it will be collapsed from wilt and probably significantly harmed by that drought. So just in my case, and I'm guessing in most people's cases, it's easier to manage them in the ground than in containers. It doesn't really hurt the plant. If it's a full sun plant, to plant it out in full sun, yes, there's some transplant wilt and all that kind of stuff. Water carefully, water thoroughly when you plant it, check daily, water as needed. My biggest concern with not planting them, holding onto them, is you're going to, one, perhaps miss a watering, which will be really crucial. Two, you're going to put them in the shade. That's not good for full sun plants to put them in the shade, even if they're in a little 4-inch pot, because we go through this at our nursery all the time. When plants for special orders come in, our special order section for temporarily holding them is the shaded side of the building. If it's something like a lavender, or a flat of 4-inch something, if they stay in the shade for 2 or 3 days, it affects them. The color of the flower changes, they stretch, the new growth comes out with a thinner leaf coating and so on. So it is important for full sun plants to be kept in the sun as much as possible. It doesn't have to be all day sun, morning sun, afternoon shade is fine. But I'm very concerned about taking home a bunch of peppers and squash and pumpkin plants that you just bought, setting them in the shade where they get no direct sun and trying to keep them watered while you wait for the temperatures to be cooler. It's better for the plant, in my opinion, my experience, to be in the ground. The next question that came up real quickly was, should I shade the plant? Sure, if you want to, but they don't need it. These are full sun plants. So you're thinking, I like to put it this way, you're thinking about how you would feel out there. Okay, you would want to be shaded for sure. You wouldn't want to be out there when it's 102. These are plants, that's where they're from. They're used to it.
When you were talking about the problems of keeping them in pots, yeah. I was thinking about another one, which is some of these are very fast growers and their roots will get all, you know, root bound in just a few days.
Yeah. What I do personally is when they come home, I have a table set up, one of those folding tables. It's set up right outside the back door, which is a place that gets sun several hours of the day, but not absolutely every moment of the day. As soon as the plant comes home now, because I know myself, I take it out and I move it up to the bigger pot. If it's in a 4-inch pot, it goes into 1 gallon container. I have about 30 pumpkin, melon, squash, cucumbers in 1 gallon cans. They're easy to water. I just transplanted them a few days ago. They have extra soil around them. They're in a nice soil that retains moisture. And so I have just found, you know, personally, and if you don't want to go to this expense, that's fine, but this has worked really, really well for me. Keep a bag of the best quality potting soil you feel you can afford. Keep a supply of quart pots and 1 gallon containers on hand. You can bring home any size pot from the nursery at that point, whether it's little 6-packs or 3-inch pots or 4-inch pots. As soon as it gets home, unless you're going to go right out to the garden and plant it, take it to that little table, transplant it to the next size up. water it thoroughly. Those plants go, yeah, you need to water them daily like most container plants, but it's easy. There's a hose nearby. They're in a place right near your back door instead of 500 feet out in the garden. More to the point, their roots are quickly going to go down further into that soil. So as an example, tomato plants, where I would shift them from the 4-inch pot into a gallon can, I went to plant some of those 7 days later because I'd been thinking I'd hold them longer, but I didn't need to. In 7 days, the roots had hit the bottom of the pot, were already beginning to circle. 7 days in a 1 gallon can from a 4-inch pot. They gained that much root growth. The tops looked fine. They didn't even droop. They didn't miss a beat. And you're planting them. This is the way to look at it from a cost perspective. Spending a little more on the potting soil, you don't need any fertilizer for that plant. It's already in the potting soil. You can just go ahead and take that out like any 1 gallon container, plant it. You've got this nice little bump of potting soil that contains, in our case, bat guano or dried chicken manure or something like that. So it's basically fertilized for the early part of the season. More to the point, then I don't have to rush home and hurry out there to get a 3-inch squash plant or something in the ground. I've shifted it to the appropriate container. So yes, they get root bound very quickly. In particular, members of Cucurbitaceae, squash, pumpkins, melons, that kind of thing, really concern me because if they're root bound, that plant usually doesn't do well. My old friend Debbie Flower will tell you when you get out, she's a former professor at American River on Farmer Fred's program all the time, and she mentions this every opportunity she gets on his show. Don't buy the overgrown members of that family that you see at garden centers. Don't buy the ones that are flowering, grown all over the place. They will struggle to establish, and she's absolutely right. So I take them, if I'm going to do them for myself, I take them as they're just getting to that stage, and I would be throwing them out or discounting them or something. I'll take them home, gash up the roots, put them in a gallon can. 7 to 10 days later, they're ready to go out in the ground and they're fully rooted to the bottom. So better to keep them moving. We really harp on that, and this is the reason. But also, it's easier for you to manage your timing of your planting. We forgot to do public service announcements, all that.
We forgot. I haven't forgot.
Okay, let's do PS. Go for it.
Okay, so I don't know how many of you listeners know about the Davis School Arts Foundation, a wonderful organization doing great work. Well, this year, the Davis Music Festival is raising money for them. So Davis Music Festival will run Friday, June 14th through Sunday, June 16th, with performances of over 40 bands across 8 venues, and the benefits go to Davis School Arts Foundation. You can find their schedule and all of the dates and places at thedavismusicfest.com. Now, that's the public service announcement. Now we're going to do the catered part, because right. KDRT is involved with the Davis Music Fest. In fact, we are going to be broadcasting from two of the events. And the first one, Friday, June 14th, beginning at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you can come to Sudworks Docks, which is at 2001 Second Street. That's east of L Street. And it'll be, if you can't get there in person, well, listen, it'll be live on the radio. And then the other one is the next day, Saturday, June 15th, featuring the performance of Anton Barbeau, the Sam Chase, and Megan Slankard. And that's all happening at Armadillo Music, which is at 207 F Street, between 2nd and 3rd Streets. Lots of stuff happening, and KDRT is right in the middle of it.
Yeah, we'll be there broadcasting live. Well, not you and I, but KDRT will be. KDRT is community radio. We rely on contributions to fund our operating costs. If you like the Davis Garden Show and all this other stuff, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button.
So, Don, we have questions in the email, and Ashdale writes to us, I know that ash trees are generally not recommended here for a myriad of reasons, but as they are the name of the trees that I'm named for, I do have an attachment to them. Is there an ash tree that I could grow here without too much struggle?
Yes. Well, ash trees grow just fine here. This is the thing. Ash trees grow very well in quite a range of areas. We're talking about the genus Fraxinus, F-R-A-X-I-N-U-S. They're widely used as street trees in Midwest and East, and here in Davis as well. Modesto ash, moraine ash, chamel ash, raywood ash, all popular trees in this area. They grow just fine. The problem is imminent pests in particular. So you could plant an ash tree on your property and be aware that perhaps in as soon as 10 years, more likely 15 to 20 years, The emerald ash borer will probably invade Sacramento Valley from Oregon, where it's now well established, or perhaps brought in from the east of the Mississippi regions, where it is decimating everything in the genus. Until that happens, your ash tree will grow fine. So I don't recommend ash trees at all for street trees, shade trees, parks. You know, we're on this big committee that's developing tree lists. We took the whole genus off completely, whether it's the city parks department or the arboretum. They're not going to be planting ash trees, but they'll grow fine. It's just you're planting a plant that has a high likelihood of not being with us a generation from now. There are native ash species in the genus Fraxinus. If you go to calscape.org or some of the other sites like that, you will see species that are actually riparian species here in the valley, as well as on the coast. Ash Fraxinus are some of the most common trees you encounter in parks and so forth as you go up the coast and on into Oregon. So there's plenty of species you can grow. I would suggest you look for a smaller one so that this doesn't become a big problem for someone down the road, you know, having to take it out. But they'll grow fine until that happens. Now, Raywood ash, for example, was introduced by the Saratoga Horticultural Foundation. Small, well-mannered tree, gets to about 20 to 25 feet. We still have a fair number of them around Davis. A borer started hitting that tree in the 1970s, but there's still plenty of them around, which tells you something about that particular borer. It'll kill a branch. You have that branch pruned out. The tree goes along 4 or 5 years. It'll kill another branch. And it's a manageable pest, but when a tree species has a pest that's going to disfigure it over many years, we're obviously not going to recommend it. Other than that, though, it's a basically very healthy tree and does very well. So if I were looking for a small ash to put in the yard and put it in a place where it wouldn't be that big a deal if it came out 20, 30 years down the road, Raywood ash would still be one I would consider. Common name is claret ash. The fall color is beautiful. It's a manageable size. It's not a huge, huge tree. And well, it can, I suppose it can get mistletoe. That's another issue with some of them, but that's something that can be pruned out. There are, you know, anthracnose blight hits the foliage on many ash species and cultivars in the spring, but they outgrow it. So none of the problems are something that's going to kill it immediately or disfigure it immediately. These are mostly imminent pests and one that's present but does harm but not fatal harm. So that's one that I would look at. And it has done very well in the San Francisco Bay Area, all up and down the coast. It was introduced, as I say, by Saratoga Horticultural Foundation. You know where they're from. And it did very well for a long time until that borer problem showed up. And at that point, people stopped using it. But if you're in Davis, it's the ash tree that's in the parking lot near Nugget Market in North Davis. And they're doing fine with very little irrigation, I would note, in that parking lot. So that's one I would look at. Or if you're doing native trees, I just had a back and forth email with someone who wanted to know if I could, they have a rural property up in Capay Valley. If you're in Yolo County, you know where that is. And they wanted to know about growing the native ash species and whether I could get it. And they also asked about white alder, which is native here. I said, well, yeah, I can get it for you, but I don't recommend it. Here's why. And we went back and forth. But in that situation, okay, maybe an ash tree is fine if you know that there's a chance of this pest problem coming along in the future that you would have to manage, or perhaps would even be fatal to the tree at some point. So it's not like you're going to look at an ugly, disfigured tree all the time. You're just going to have some decision to make a few years to several or maybe even many years down the road about that tree. So my not recommending ash is because of these imminent pests, one of which is present, one of which is really destructive and appears to be on its way. So it's a choice you can make. But again, we're just saying don't plant this as your city street tree. Don't plant this in the middle of the park. Why bother? You're going to have to take it out probably. And, you know, you're making work for someone down the road. But a small to medium-sized ash or one of our native species in the right setting, fine. I just want people, when they buy a plant, to be aware of these pest problems. I'm going to digress here for a moment. Do you ever feel like walking up to someone's door and knocking on the door and saying, hey, there's something about your landscape I want to talk to you about. You don't know me, but you're making a terrible mistake. Okay. Okay. There's a road I drive on in Dixon. And I love to drive on it because it's so interesting, the things people are doing with their front landscapes. And someone there has rototilled their front, which they seem to do every other year. And they went out and they bought a tree and they planted the tree. And the tree that they chose, I can tell, is a Leylandii cypress. It still has the tag on it. They bought a big old 15-gallon specimen and they planted it 3 feet from their driveway. I want to go up and knock on the door and say, one, this tree is going to die in 7 to 10 years. Trust me on this. Two, if you are going to keep it, it's too close to your driveway. Move it over 5 or 10 feet into your yard. I don't do that kind of thing because people just don't take that right. It's sad, but they don't like that kind of criticism. But this is a case where they went out and they bought a tree that happened to be in the nursery yard of almost certainly Home Depot or Lowe's, the kinds of places that sell trees and shrubs but don't have nursery professionals on staff. Shouldn't be in our industry at all. I said that 30 years ago about the Leylandii cypress, and I got in a big, lively debate with people in the nursery industry then about a tree that we knew was always going to die in 7 to 10 years. We knew that then, and they're still growing them and selling them. And this guy went out and bought one. So if someone asked me to order them a Leylandii cypress, which sometimes happens, they see it, they read about it or something. Oh, this is fast growing. It's really drought tolerant. Can you get me one of these? I said, I can, but I won't. And here's why. If you really want, having had that whole preamble as to why I don't recommend it, you want me to order it? Okay. But someone here just walked in, probably bought it at the kind of place that sells trees without any nursery professionals on staff. So sometimes it's a value judgment, or let's say a risk evaluation that you're going to take. And if it's going in a front yard where cutting it down is no big deal, well, then it's no big deal. But if it's the big old shade tree in your backyard and you're really going to count on that and you know it has an imminent pest problem, then you perhaps shouldn't plant that species. And if you're going to buy a Leylandii cypress, well, don't. But if you do, don't plant it 3 feet from the driveway. If you happen to be listening, I'm not coming up to your door, but maybe you'll get the message from someone. Maybe you know a master gardener who comes over for drinks every now and then. Ask them what they think about this Leylandii cypress you just planted by your driveway.
You know, Don, it is also quite possible that someone went out to buy a cypress, one of those tall, skinny things,
right,
and got the wrong thing.
Very likely, yeah, yeah. Hey, we got a note here from Sophia, who was dealing with water restrictions down there in Lodi, California. Thank you so much for your advice. Please see a few photos of the weeds I am battling. They are not impacted by the water restrictions. I know you mentioned covering them. Can you go more into the options for this, please? And thank you again. Stay healthy, stay safe. Thank you, Sophia.
And the three photos that she sent, the first one has some grasses and then something that's not a monocot. It's a dicot, I think.
It is a dicot. It's not weed, which is...
It's not a weed. It's
not
it's
weed. Not like, a weed. Like you tie a knot on your shoe, that kind of knot. Not
K-N-O-T.
K-N-O-T, not weed. It's a vigor. Let's go into these one by one. The grass that's there is one of the winter annual grasses that came up with the rains, grows, flowers. It's about to go to seed. This is a great time to pull them, and you'll find it pulls very, very easily. Not weed is a very, very persistent one because within about 5 weeks of germinating, it's already gone to seed. So it's one of those ones that it's, as with any weed, you want to ask yourself, what is this weed's adaptive strategy? How is it outwitting us? Why do we have so much fast growth, but more common is excessive fecundity, high seed production. This isn't spurge, but it functions much the same. Fast seed production. So from sprouting to seeding is only a matter of a few weeks with this particular one, knotweed, as well as spurge, which is another common summertime weed.
And if you look at the top of that photo up there, there's something which looks like that nutgrass. And the nutgrass strategy is to have a nut at the base of the plant so that even if you pull the plant out, that nut stays there for next year.
Well, I was going to ignore that part of the picture because that's a much longer conversation. So we'll talk about nut sedge maybe another time. But what she took a picture of was the knotweed. And the knotweed is an easy one to pull. It is a single plant coming from a single seed. You can see where it's sprouting from. It's not like spreading by rhizomes. It's not, you don't have to dig out the whole thing. Grasp and tug and you will be rid of it. It's flowering now. This plant in your picture will be seeding within about 2 weeks. So I suggest you get out there and hand pull both of those.
The next picture looks to me like to be a dandelion?
This is a dandelion relative. It's a composite. This is, I'm drawing a blank on the name, but it sends up a spike of flowers. It gets very high. Pollinators love them. And then they turn into fluffy seed heads, which scatter on the wind. Again, it's about to embark on its flowering stage. So the two things to remember about most weeds is that one, they're easiest to control when they're in the 2 to 4 leaf stage. In other words, young seedlings, of course, are much easier to control than bigger established weeds. Generally, just chopping off a weed when it's just a seedling with a hoe, even many perennial weeds, you'll get very good control doing that. That was back in the case of this plant, probably in February. So that's an important time to go out and monitor for young weed seedlings coming up. A few minutes with a hoe, or you can just mulch them. I mean, if you're inclined to use top kill herbicides, these low toxicity herbicides, you can use those. Those are all options. But right now, it's about to expand and get very tall and flower. And well, the flowers do draw pollinators. Bees and butterflies love the flowers. Almost any weed in the daisy family. It's kind of a rude thing to do to your neighbor to let the fluffy seed heads form and fly away into their yard. So I would grasp that one wearing a glove and tug on it, because this one has hairs on the stem that can irritate your skin.
And then the third picture, some more grass. And then there's this thing with little tiny orangey red. You know, it's beautiful. I wouldn't mind having this in my yard. This is a weed and not a flower?
Well, if you like it and you keep it, it's no longer a weed. As we all know, the definition of weed is a plant that's out of place or a plant that you don't want. So when I took a course in weed science to illustrate that on the first day of the class, the professor showed a picture. I think it was a field of sunflowers with a few corn plants in them, because they'd grown corn there the previous year. Now, by definition, corn was the weed in a field of sunflowers. Next year, when the sunflowers come up in the corn, the sunflowers will be the weed. That way, he was just making a point. So this is Scarlet Pimpernel, which is a charming name. If you do a Google search, you'll find many literary references. My mother made the mistake Lois was making there. She said, oh, this is kind of cute. I like this. It's kind of pretty. I won't worry about it. A couple of years later, it was a solid carpet of her succulent and cactus garden. So we spent a lot of time pulling it out. If you don't mind a plant taking over, I mean, we plant things that are going to do that intentionally. I think in a recent show, we talked about things you can see that'll come back on their own. Well, then you can leave this. Now, Scarlet Pimpernel is a funny one. It's a cute little plant that only gets a few inches to a foot tall. Has this really interesting orange colored flower. I mean, orange stands out, happened to be my mother's favorite flower color. So she liked it for that reason too. And it pulls out pretty easily. The it's not going to crowd out plants in your garden, so you could leave it up to a point, but bear in mind that it does increase pretty rapidly from seed. It has a bunch of common names, and one of my favorite common names is poor man's barometer or poor man's weather glass. Why would you call something a poor man's weather anything? It turns out that the flowers are only open when the sun is shining. They close in dull weather, which gives it the name poor man's weather glass. So it's one of those plants, and there are many flowers that do this. They close when it's like gazanias will close up when they're in the shade or when clouds are over them. So there are flowers that are only open when the sun is shining. Not sure how that's a weather glass. I think it's pretty easy to tell what the weather is if it's cloudy, but this is a flower that responds to dull weather, hence the common name, Scarlet Pimpernel. Not a huge problem. This is not something that's going to massively crowd out other things in your garden, but you will find that if you let it go for a couple of years, you'll have a lot of it. It's a very easy one to hoe out, and I don't think I'd worry as much about that as about the one you didn't ask about, which was the nut sedge. We'll save that topic for another show.
How do you cover up these weeds, and what do you come over them with, and will it work?
You can smother them with any of a number of things. You can smother weeds with straw. You can use arborist wood chips. You can purchase bark. You can make a mix of bark and compost. That's one that I happen to really like to see people use. Each of those has advantages and drawbacks. Arborist wood chips are free. The drawback is you get 15 or so yards at a time and they land in your driveway or on the street, and then you get to wheelbarrow them where they go. They work really well, but it's a large volume. And for anyone with a sort of a normal size yard, it's probably way more than you need. On that topic, 4 to 6 inches deep is fine. It doesn't matter how much you put down. It doesn't, you know, it's a chunky, what Dr. Linda Chalker Scott up at Washington State University, who strongly touts the use of arborist wood chips, she calls them geometric mulch. These are mulches that are coarse, chunky, have air exchange, water runs through them. They don't block moisture getting through. They don't make a saturated zone like soil or something very fine would do. And so they don't increase the risk of disease, even if they're crowded up against the stem of the plant. I mean, she's studied that. So it's the kind of thing where, yeah, if you have enough to put 8 or 10 inches all around your yard, go for it. It doesn't hurt, and it will, you know, it will definitely be better for the plants. What we like about them is they're wet. They're trees that were just ground up that are still have moisture in them. And there will be some bark in there, but not a lot. Bark is hydrophobic. Bark usually contains suberin, which is what makes it shed water. You know, the botanical name of cork oak, Quercus suber, referring to the suberin and the bark. And bark itself breaks down very slowly. So while bark will gradually improve soil, compost does it right away. Compost, if you've ever put an intraso on your garden, you've noticed by the end of the season, it's gone. It just breaks down and goes into the soil, whereas bark is still there and you can still walk on it. So if you don't happen to have a source of arborist wood chips or the inclination to move, you know, 15 yards worth of arborist wood chips, and you don't have another material that'll work as well, good quality compost topped with bark has become a popular option for a lot of folks because the compost is improving the soil right away. Worms move up into it, or organisms invade it and root into it essentially, and it starts becoming part of the whole soil rhizosphere very quickly. Bark, on the other hand, is there on the top shedding water, so it's better for you to walk on over a long period of time. It breaks down rather slowly, makes a great path. So my suggestion generally, if you're not going to get something free like arborist wood chips, or you're not going to use straw, which is another option, that you just get a bunch of good compost, spread that all around. That's great for the soil. And then since compost tracks and blows around and stuff, water it down to settle it, top it in the areas you're going to walk with a nice pathway bark, micro bark, something like that. If you're not going to walk there except intermittently and you want the bark to last longer, get the larger size, the medium or even large, coarser bark. But bear in mind that bark sticks around for a long time. Compost breaks down more quickly. Compost is better for the soil initially, and most compost products that you buy nowadays are likely to have some kind of fertilizer added as well. So compost plus bark is one option. Arborist wood chips, which you can get by going to, I think it's chipdrop.net, and at some point you'll come home and find 15 cubic yards or so of wood chips in your driveway or in the street, which you have to then move. I can tell you that's about 90 wheelbarrow loads. I've done the math for people. Or you can go out and buy bales of straw. And I have found that in the valley here, straw makes a great mulch in this situation. And 6 inches of straw spread over that bed will shade out weeds very effectively. The one thing to remember, there's always one species that gets through, grows through the mulch, whatever it is, whether it has a rhizome like Bermuda grass, so it just runs out and comes up on the side, or it has a ability to push up through like nutsedge or some of the fescue grasses. Be aware of those. If you happen to get a giant pile of wood chips, leave some of it in a pile on the side of your yard somewhere where you can go get more. So if a weed pops through and you don't have a moment to pull it out or dig it out, or it's a weed that won't pull or dig, get another couple of shovels full and bury it. Just keep burying it. Bury it. If you prevent photosynthesis, vast majority of plants can't live. There's a few exceptions, which are interesting, but the vast majority cannot live. So burying it. Then the weeds that are the problem are those that have the adaptive strategy, the way of outsmarting us, of a storage unit, such as a bulb or a larger rhizome that stores energy and can lie down there in the soil, waiting for all that compost and bark and whatnot to finally decompose. Can be years, and then they pop up through. We had nutsedge on our property at one point. We covered it with a trailer. A trailer that my parents used when they came up to visit for 10 years. That trailer was pulled away finally, disposed of, and nutsedge came back. So it lay in the ground for 10 years. It's waiting for us to restore its habitat so it could resurge and come back. I buried it repeatedly under leaves and other stuff and eventually did crowd it out, but it took another 10 years roughly to get rid of it. So there's a weed that'll fit every situation. There's an adaptive strategy that'll get through anything we've talked about, even herbicides. I mean, there's you know, well-known herbicides. There are weeds that are resistant to them. So whatever you do, as I've always said, is encouraging some weeds and discouraging others. And you just have to be aware of the ones you're inadvertently encouraging, even as you get 90% control of everything else that's out there.
Okay, another question. Two people came in and one morning, two different people, asking what to do about powdery mildew on a crepe myrtle. Yeah. And up online, it said some chemical is used for mildew. And is this a reasonable thing to treat it with?
Well, some of you may be listening in the southeastern United States where mildew can be a very serious problem on crepe myrtles. But really, it frustrates me that anybody still has crepe myrtles with powdery mildew, because we've had highly mildew resistant cultivars of crepe myrtles for over 50 years. So,
and riddles aren't going to live much.
Oh, they can live for a long time. I mean, if your tree was like 60, 70 years old, then the landscaper has an excuse. But there are still nurseries out there selling the older varieties. I don't know why, because we have varieties that are so resistant that this simply shouldn't be a problem. Even in a year like this, where there's a lot of mildew, you shouldn't have much mildew on your crepe myrtles. So the simple answer in hindsight,
shovel.
Yeah, prune it with a shovel. If you're choosing a crepe myrtle, plant one that's resistant to powdery mildew. If you have powdery mildew on a crepe myrtle, when the question came up, is it reasonable to treat? I have a simple question. How are you planning to do that?
It depends on how big the tree is,
Because you'd be spraying the tree with a fungicide. Is that something that's a practical thing for you to do? Getting away from whether it's a desirable thing to do. Is that something that's a practical thing for you to do in your front or backyard? In a place like Davis, where a lot of people might see you out there spraying and be kind of aghast at the notion you're using any kind of pesticide, it's a tree. I, in years past, have had spray rigs that would spray trees. They were gas powered. They could go 20, 30 feet up into a tree. This is when, you know, in years past, if, let's say you're doing an orchard, you want to spray your dormant spray on your fruit trees, you might have that kind of a sprayer. You might even have a backpack sprayer. Most of these fungicides have to be done on a preventative basis. So you start before the mildew attacks and you spray every 7 to 14 days through the spring. Is that a way that you want to spend your time in the garden? I won't even get into the particular pesticide they're asking about. If you go online, you'll find recommendations for particular fungicides. And if you're going to do that, I strongly suggest you download the PDF of a label, read it, read the precautionary statements, particularly with respect to your own safety and also reducing impacts on wildlife and environmental impacts. And think about whether the cosmetic issue of mildew on the leaves of your crepe myrtle is worth all of that and all the hassle. It's not something I want to spend my time doing out in the garden, but if you've really got a bad problem with mildew on a crepe myrtle, prune it with a shovel, go get one of the varieties that is resistant or another type of tree and plant that instead. I know that's not the most, you know, not the answer you're looking for. Or here's another thing, they still bloom. Okay, they still bloom just fine, so don't worry too much about it. But if it's on a variety that's susceptible, they're going to get it every year, not just in a rainy spring year like we have. They're going to get powdery mildew every year. So give some thought to whether that tree should simply come out and should be replaced with some either another variety that's resistant or something entirely different. I've got to say this briefly about crepe myrtles. You know, at our nursery, crepe myrtle sales have tanked, and there's a reason. The crepe myrtle aphid is very well established in the Sacramento Valley. It's been here for 10 or 20 years now, and every crepe myrtle I look at has it to some degree. It's specific to crepe myrtles, as so many aphids are. It's very host specific. It's present all summer. The tree is fine in spite of it. You get good vigor and bloom. If you look at a crepe myrtle and it's kind of shiny, then it's probably got crepe myrtle aphid. Lots of ladybugs, lots of lacewings on there, but there's still lots and lots of crepe myrtle aphid. So underneath almost any crepe myrtle now, there's a sticky drip. So I'm driving down Russell Boulevard and I see the brand new landscaping that's gone in at the new housing at the University of California and right over the bike parking area, landscape architect specified crepe myrtles. So it's going to be sticky drip all over the bike parking area at this particular residential area. Landscape architects, if you're listening, don't use crepe myrtles in places where people gather, people park, people walk. There's hardscape surfaces or anything like that. A lawn is fine. A landscape area where it'll just drip on the landscape plants is fine. But over a hardscape surface where people, where hundreds of students are going to be parking their bicycles, probably not a good plan. I'm guessing that landscape architect is not aware of the crepe myrtle aphid. Lots of people are not. This is a chronic problem. The only way to treat it is imidacloprid, a systemic insecticide. The date of this broadcast is May 2024. As of January 1, 2025, home gardeners will not be allowed to buy imidacloprid in California. So you won't even be able to treat it if you wanted to. I wouldn't recommend treating a flowering tree with a systemic insecticide, but it's legal now. It won't be legal then. So let's stop using crepe myrtles in places where that drip is going to be a problem. As I say, our sales of crepe myrtles have dropped rather dramatically, and I'm fine with that. I'll show you Oklahoma redbud. I'll show you desert willow. There's a bunch of other trees we can talk about. But I think the time of crepe myrtles in public areas, particularly with hardscape features, has passed.
Well, I want to change subjects now. Let's talk about shrubs and small trees for beneficial insects and wildlife. Mm-hmm. Now, usually we're talking about things for either aesthetics. It's got flowers or it's a lovely bush or whatever, or fruit. But for the insects and the wildlife, we have to consider a little different things. Yeah. So talk to me about that.
Well, one of the things that we keep running into is a lot of folks want pollinator gardens, and they're focusing on what I call the glamorous wildlife, you know, the hummingbirds and the butterflies. They're not thinking about those boring moths and the leather-winged beetles that feed on their aphids and that kind of stuff.
Or the foxes,
right. they're focusing on the pretty ones, like everybody's planting milkweed right now. All right, that's great. That's a pollinator garden, and it's good for the monarchs. But what about that leather-winged beetle that spends its larval stage in leaf debris on the ground? What about the birds that are coming through your garden and want a place to hide? And also other things that can just be an easy part of your landscape that draw wildlife, that draw bees, whether native or non-native, that draw birds for one reason or another. And this is the part that seems to get ignored a lot in the landscaping for beneficials discussions. Pollinator gardens are generally herbaceous perennials. They're flowering plants. They're things like California fuchsia and penstemons and salvias, all of which are wonderful plants, things like that. But that's all ground level flowering stuff that's pretty to us and draws the glamorous wildlife. But if you want to get songbirds, if you want to get bigger birds, if you want to get the native bees out early, if you want to get all those different kinds of wildlife that you're not really thinking of when you're focusing on those more glamorous ones, you should have something blooming all the time. And to have a garden of flowers all the time takes more planning and more work. One of the things we're finding at Tree Davis, for example, we're planting what we're calling climate-ready landscapes, where we plant trees in a park. We've done these gardens around them. The public really loves them. There'll be zauschneria, and there'll be penstemons, and there'll be salvias blooming and so forth. We've also found that's a lot of hand weeding to get those things established. Thank goodness for some of our volunteers who are coming out and just pulling weeds for us. And it is more work to get flowering perennials and annuals blooming all the time. That's what gardeners like to do, but that may not be what you as a listener want to do or what someone is going to implement in a local park. The suggestion I'm making is that we, Tree Davis, and also you as someone who's maybe putting in a new landscape or taking out shrubs and putting new ones in, look for something that blooms so that you have flowering shrubs at every season of the year. And there are shrubs that bloom in January. There are shrubs that bloom in August and so forth. And they may not be, I'll give you an example. What's one of Lois's favorite shrubs?
Abutilon.
Try again.
Zelazma?
Yeah, there you go. Zelazma. I mean, abutilon's fine, but it's not really a shrub. Not really. Abutilon's not really a shrub in the sense we're talking about here.
Zelazma, it's a multi-trunked little bush.
Yeah, zelazma is a big old background shrub, and it can even be trained as a lovely understory tree. Here's something most people don't really know about it. When I mentioned, almost nobody has noticed this. When it's in bloom, it's massively attractive to European honeybees. If you go near a xylosma that's flowering, there'll be bees all over it. Now, if you're clipping it,
you
like
hear it hum from the other side, yeah, of the yard.
It's one of those plants, and the flowers are basically the color of the leaves, so they're kind of chartreuse, and you hardly notice them. But you'll suddenly notice there's bees all over it, and it's not just European honeybees; all kinds of bees going to it. So it blooms in mid to late summer, and if you let it grow more naturally, you'll get more blooms. If you let it grow more naturally, it actually can turn into a lovely small tree, so it can be part of an understory planting. So this is just a common landscape plant that can actually be part of a well-planned landscape for wildlife. And there's lots and lots of other shrubs. That was just one example. There's some that are natives, such as baccharis and redbuds and things like that. But as you're choosing your backbone plants for your landscape, try to get something blooming in every season. That's really the key for drawing hummingbirds, the key for drawing butterflies, and all this other wildlife that is perhaps equally important, but as I always like to say, less glamorous, because they aren't showy or pretty. They're things that are doing great things for you in your garden. If you're not having aphid problems and your neighbor is having aphid problems, there's a pretty good chance it's because there's a Pittosporum tobira nearby that is providing habitat for beneficial insects that then come in and feed on your aphids. And it also is nice when it's blooming.
So we don't have to have flowers that people can see.
Right.
Enjoy. You mentioned the xylosma. There is a Ribes viburnifolium. Now, mm-hmm. That's an evergreen, ankle-high, creepy thing. And the flowers on that are about the size of the head of a pin.
Yeah.
And are beautiful. If you're a photographer, go check this plant out, because you can get some great macro shots on it. But it also, the little things like it. And one of the things that you said is that you have to have lots of volunteers weeding.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you have a lot of volunteers weeding, I think you're missing a whole bunch of plants, because there are plants that will make such a thicket on the ground that nothing's going to grow underneath them once they get established.
Absolutely. So when I've given presentations, I did a webinar a couple of years ago on weed management, and the take home was weeds are growing there because nothing else is. They're opportunists. And I have had areas on my own farm where I've planted a couple of plants that I should mention as extremely effective at managing weeds for me. Artemisia Powis Castle, if you have room for it, nothing grows through that plant. And if you irrigate it normally like a garden plant for the first year or two, it'll spread quickly, make a nice dense cover. It appears to have an allelopathic effect, that is to say a chemical effect, even more than just shading and out competing. Nothing grows through Artemisia Powis Castle. And then you can back off on the irrigation once it's established. It can actually be unirrigated once established. That's one of the sagebrush group. It's not native, and the native ones tend not to have the density you're after, but the Powis Castle definitely does. Salvia, some of the native California salvias, particularly the garden hybrid Dara's Choice and some of the forms of Salvia clevelandii, they get dense enough and spread enough that nothing grows through them. And again, there may be an allelopathic function there, but it's also just shading and out competing. Bacchus, coyote bush, very rarely do you see anything growing through coyote bush. On my own property, the champion of this category is Tuscan blue rosemary. Established plants of Tuscan blue rosemary, one, it's a tall, big rosemary, 4 to 5 foot plant, blooms midwinter. Very showy blooms December, January, February. So aside from your native hummingbird that's hanging out here in the wintertime, lots of other things. On a sunny day, there's all kinds of bees on those flowers because not much else is blooming. And the density provides cover for small songbirds, and nothing grows through rosemary. In fact, looking at the mint family in general is a good starting point, because salvias and rosemary, Tucrium are also in that same category. So these are woody plants that spread and shade out, crowd out, and suppress the growth of weeds once established. I do recommend watering well, correctly, deep watering the first summer or two on each of the ones I just mentioned. But each of those, even the non-native rosemary, can actually basically be without irrigation once it's established. And bigger shrubs, one of the things we're looking at in a new climate-ready landscape that Tree Davis is going to be doing out in one of the parks, this is an open park, just bare soil. So you plant a toyon, and you give it enough room to develop. You plant a redbud and you give it enough room to develop, so no one's gonna have to prune it, and you train the maintenance crews to stop pruning these larger evergreen shrubs, or deciduous in the case of the redbud. They'll get up big enough that even if you have weeds underneath them, they'll shade them out, and ultimately the city crews can come in and mow them or use their weed eaters and hopefully not hit the trunk, but they can get into easy sort of macro scale weed management, as can you. Grevilleas in general, big plants, many of them are very large shrubs that shade out and crowd out weeds. Until they're established, you can just mow the weeds around them or chop them down with whatever. You don't have to go in with an herbicide, you don't have to hand pull them. The plant gets above them and shades them out. And so in the long run, these are much easier landscapes, and the many of them have very spectacular flowers. The key would be to go to a chart such as you will find at redwoodbarn.com shortly and look for the different seasons of bloom. And there's some things that bloom off and on year round. Bottle brush is a good example. Callistemon, my regular old red flowered callistemon, has blooms every couple months, every season of the year. Texas Ranger, the Leucophyllum texanum, has blooms every couple months, spring, summer, fall. So you get a long season of bloom out of plants like that. But especially look for the ones that bloom in the winter, which can be a very challenging time. Mahonia is a good example of something that blooms in the winter time. Or the ones that bloom in the late summer to early fall, which can be a challenging time to get color. Bacchus, which is blooming on the coyote brush. So you just look for shrubs with a different eye to what you're choosing them for. Give them enough room that people aren't going to be pruning them. Wildlife doesn't like you pruning those shrubs. They want them to grow more naturally. Eleagnus, you know, it's always clipped like a hedge. It's a great plant if you leave it and allow it to grow more naturally. It has really fragrant blossoms. You don't really see them, but they're super fragrant. And the plant itself is big enough to shade out weeds,
crowd out weeds and looks very nice and make great cover for birds. Why? Because it's a little bit thorny. So that's another thing, which might be a negative when you're choosing it, but in the case of wildlife, can be a positive.
You talk about some species that bloom all season, now every part of the year. But you know, you can do the same thing where maybe one species doesn't bloom all the time, right, but another related species is doing something. I'm thinking particularly of the ribes. Now, ribes are currants and gooseberries, mm-hmm, and the gooseberries will goose you. They're the ones with thorns, and if they don't have thorns, it's a currant. But the evergreen currants that I love are a low ground cover thing. They'll throw up a stalk, maybe 2-3 feet tall, and then it'll bend over, touch the ground, and root. And so you end up with this ankle high area. You can't walk through it. It'll hide anything that falls into it. And it is compatible with other ribes. So you could have a little area with this, mostly the viburnifolium, but have one of the other ribes, like Ribes aureum or Malvaceum or whatever, that is not evergreen, but blooms copiously in times when you want them to bloom, like a December.
Yeah, the winter and spring bloom for the ribes, and then there's things that are summer bloomers. The key would be when people tend to repeat one species all around a yard, even if it blooms, you only get that season of bloom. But if you had your, you know, different forms of ribes or Mahonia, which is the Oregon grape, Mahonia aquifolium, which blooms December, January, that's a time that there's not much going on in the garden. You'll definitely see lots of things going to those flowers. And then make sure, since it doesn't bloom at all in spring, summer, fall, that you have summer blooming plants, spring blooming plants. So choose your shrubs for, aside from giving a different season of bloom, try to choose them so you have something blooming all the time, but also so that they have sufficient density for cover and habitat. And that means typically not clipping like a hedge, but allowing them to grow more naturally, which means you have to give them enough space. And the most common error I see on design plans, whether done by professional landscape architects or landscape designers or home gardeners, is putting things too close together. And then you have to go in and prune. Better to let them grow more naturally. One of my favorite shrubs is one that is horribly abused in landscapes. That's Abelia, A-B-E-L-I-A. It has a lovely arching, informal habit, and it blooms off and on pretty much all the time. It's attractive to hummingbirds and lots of little insects as well. Most commonly you see that, you think it's a boxwood the way it's being pruned. I mean, they're clipped within an inch of their life because they have these arching branches that seem to flummox gardeners who don't know how to handle that kind of informal growth habit. But an Abelia grandiflora, given 6 to 8 feet of space, will be very attractive to songbirds. It'll have blooms March, April, all the way into October, November, and it has a lovely growth habit. So try to work with the growth habit of the plant rather than force the plant into the shape of your yard. I mean, choose something that you can give enough room to and let it grow more naturally. So typically, woody plants are going to be anywhere from 6 to 12 feet apart when you do this. And they don't all have to be evergreen, but you probably should have a backbone of evergreen plants chosen for a season of bloom that you'll get something blooming all the time. Then interspersed with that, we've also talked about this as a hedge option. Take the flowering deciduous thing, like flowering quince. All right, my flowering quince is still blooming, and it started in January. And there's a variety called Cameo that's in bloom almost all the time. So you can actually get those flowers in its season, typically January, February, into early March, but can have scattered bloom at other times. And then it's deciduous, so it's bare in the winter, but if it's got a Abelia or a Feijoa or something nearby behind it, around it, you'll still get the privacy you're after, you'll get the density that the wildlife is after, and then you'll have these flowers suddenly popping out at you in their particular season. So aside from the advantage of mixed species where you avoid significant pest or disease problems wiping out your whole hedge, you get more wildlife, you get a more natural appearance. You can prune these. I'm not saying don't touch them. You can prune them to shape, to keep from touching each other if you happen to want that. You can enhance the growth habit of the plant. And in the case of the bigger ones, right now we're taking out a tree along our driveway that is just a big messy thing that's falling apart. Well, it happens there are three toyons around that tree that are about 7 years old, and they're about 15 feet tall in 7 years, which that's how toyons grow on my property. They look like a giant shrub right now. If we don't replace the tree. We may just prune them up to make them more tree-like, which you can do with almost any of these evergreen shrubs we're talking about. Not like we talked about earlier in the program where you stake it up, but where you just prune them up to enhance the trunk. And certain of them, I'll mention one in particular, this will be a good one to finish with, Arbutus marina, or the other forms of Arbutus. Arbutus, best known one is strawberry tree, that's Arbutus unido, heavy fruit set, very messy, don't plant it in most yards. Dwarf versions, fruit sets not so bad, nice shrubs, but marina has become incredibly popular as a tree that can get to 20 to 30 feet if you allow it to. But one of the really nice things to do with it, shorten it up, have it as maybe a 15-foot tree, and prune up the lower branches because it has the same beautiful mahogany colored bark as its cousin, the madrone, and its cousins, the manzanitas. It has that kind of really, really pretty wood and trunk. So the trunk itself can become a real feature. And those kind of birds that like sort of ladders to go up into plants, they'll like those, that open thing there where they can hop right up into it. Arbutus marina, I have pictures of flowers on it every month of the year. It's one of those kind of plants that has blossoms heavily in the winter, but anytime, any month, you'll have some blossoms on there. So you're getting the blooms, they draw hummingbirds, you're getting this attractive bonus of the bark, and then the density is sufficient that it's a place, as I was pruning mine, I found a bird's nest that I wasn't aware was even in there. So evidently it makes good habitat and nesting sites for some type of songbird. I want to just take a moment here to talk about what you can still plant in your vegetable garden. So June 6, 2024, we still have about 120 days left in our summer growing season. We go all the way through September and into early October with no problem. That's enough time for tomatoes. Most people start gravitating towards smaller fruited types, Juliet, cherry types, pear tomatoes, that sort. But you still have plenty of time for early girl or some of the other early set and early ripening types. They only take about 50 days from planting, so you have loads of time for those. And you can certainly try some of the bigger fruited ones, but I would say in general, going to higher yielding, smaller fruited types might be your best bet as we go through the month of June. Eggplants and peppers, tomatillos, and the related ground cherries all have plenty of time to flower and fruit abundantly for you still. Summer squash can go in, will be producing in as little as 30 to 40 days. Winter squash goes in now for harvest in late summer and fall. By winter squash, I'm referring to the types like Hubbard squash, acorn squash, which we harvest in the fall and can store into the winter. Cucumbers can be planted all the way into August and will produce in as little as 30 to 40 days after being planted. Melons, especially musk melons and honeydews and watermelons, they take 80, 90 days, some of them over 100, but we still have that, particularly musk melons, honeydews, and watermelons. Might stay away from Crenshaw. You might be running out of time for that one at this point. This is the key planting time for pumpkins. They go in now, whether you're growing them for pies, decoration, or jack-o'-lanterns. Pumpkins are planted in the month of June. We can continue planting basil right on through the summer, all the way into the end of September, frankly, if you want to. But most people continue planting it right on through July and August. You can either keep cutting back your regular basil, let it flush out and give some more shoots that you'll keep harvesting, or let that plant flower, bees love them, and keep planting new basil plants elsewhere. And there are types of basil most nurseries will be stocking these days that flower very little or in some cases don't flower at all. So you can continue to harvest from those, Emerald Towers being a good example, all the way through September and October. It is a great time right now to plant flowers, zinnias, asters, marigolds, cosmos, verbena, portulaca, all those great summer flowers that love the heat. So you still have plenty of options for your summer flower and vegetable garden, lots of things you can plant right on through June and even into July, keeping in mind that our summer gardening season here goes all the way through the month of September, all the way to the middle of October, frequently all the way to the end of October. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore
and Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.